The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good evening, everyone. So last week I began talking about working with emotions in our mindfulness practice, and I thought I'd continue that topic this evening, because there's actually quite a bit to say, and I'm not sure I'll finish even tonight, so this might continue next week as well. So last week, in talking about working with emotions, primarily I emphasized the aspect of recognizing what our emotions are through, partly through recognizing the kinds of thoughts they produce. Getting familiar with the way they feel in the body and the kinds of thoughts they produce. So just beginning to get familiar with our habitual patterns of emotions. I encouraged you to notice whether you tend to be more on the side of aversive emotions or greedy emotions or perhaps confused emotions, and to explore, perhaps create lists of emotions that might help you to learn to recognize some of your more common emotions. Tonight I'd like to talk about working with emotions more directly with mindfulness, some tools and some techniques for connecting with mindfulness to our emotions. And our emotions can sweep us away into thoughts so easily that it can be challenging to stay connected to our experience when we're having a strong emotion. And so I'm going to talk about ways to support that this evening. So I'd like to begin with a story from the Buddha's teachings. And debate about whether to actually read it or just paraphrase it. I think I'll read. So the Buddha is starting by talking to some of his monks, and he says, "The uninstructed worldling," that's someone who hasn't had much connection with the meditation practice or is pretty new with the meditation practice, "the uninstructed worldling feels a pleasant feeling, a painful feeling, and a neither pleasant, painful nor pleasant feeling." So this is a kind of a description of one aspect of experience that we can connect with, which is whether our experience is pleasant, unpleasant, or basically neutral. All experience has this quality. Every single moment of our experience has a quality of being pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Whether it's a sight, a sound, a smell, a taste, a body sensation, or even things arising in the mind, every single experience has this feeling tone. So this is a major component of our experience. And so he's pointing this out. He says, so the uninstructed worldling feels these pleasant, painful, and neither painful nor pleasant feelings. And then he goes on to say, the instructed noble disciple too feels pleasant feeling, a painful feeling, and a neither painful nor pleasant feeling. And he asks the question, so what is the distinction, the disparity, the difference between the instructed noble disciple and the uninstructed worldling? So he's saying basically, you know, since both people who are trained in mindfulness practice and who have some degree of understanding about experience and letting go of reactivity to experience, both people who have instruction and who don't feel pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral feeling. And so what's the difference between the two? He says, when the uninstructed worldling is being contacted by a painful feeling, he sorrows, grieves, and laments. He weeps, beating his breast, and becomes distraught. Does that sound familiar? He feels two feelings, a bodily one and a mental one. So what he's pointing to here is that when we experience something unpleasant, some unpleasant bodily contact he's talking about here, when we experience some unpleasant bodily contact, we get upset about it. We react to it. And he gives an analogy to this. He says, suppose they were to strike a man with a dart, and then they were to strike him immediately afterwards with a second dart. So that man would feel a feeling caused by two darts. So when the uninstructed worldling is being contacted by a painful feeling, he feels two feelings, a bodily one and a mental one. So he's saying that when we feel a bodily painful feeling and react to it with anger, frustration, or despair, or irritation, or annoyance, or any kind of reactivity whatsoever, it's as if we're hitting ourselves with the second dart. So there's the initial painful experience of the painful feeling itself, like, you know, maybe cutting ourselves with a knife. There's the actual, the body's designed to produce pain. We're going to feel pain. So there's that initial physical pain. And then there's reactivity to it. How could I be so stupid as to have not seen where the knife would slip? And frustration about, ugh, this is going to take a while. Obviously, this is going to need stitches. I'm going to have to go to the emergency room. I don't have time for this. And we get angry at ourselves, and we maybe start beating ourselves up or get sad about, then start getting sad about the way we beat ourselves up all the time. Oh, I always beat myself up. Why do I do that? And it just proliferates. Emotions leading to other emotions, all out of this physical unpleasant experience leading to reactivity. So the Buddha talks about this as being as if we're striking ourselves with another dart. So this kind of extra experience is understood to be optional. And this is underscored by him going on to describe how someone who has been trained responds to this same painful feeling. He says, when the instructed noble disciple is contacted by a painful feeling, he does not sorrow, grieve, or lament. He does not weep, beating his breast, and become distraught. He feels one feeling, a bodily one, not a mental one. So there's not that reactivity. Imagine, just imagine what it might be like to experience a painful feeling and not react to it. Absolutely not react at all. There'd be a lot of freedom in that. You could take care of it. I mean, I think that we somehow think, oh, if I'm not reacting somehow, it means I'm dead, or I'm not responsible, or I'm not responding. But not being reactive doesn't mean not responding. So the way we react to both painful and pleasant feeling is kind of the ground out of which our emotions, in particular our afflictive emotions, our difficult emotions, are created. So it's kind of the beginning, this feeling of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral is kind of the beginning of how our emotions are generated in our minds. When something is pleasant, we tend to like it and try to figure out how to get it or keep it. So the emotions of wanting, of excitement, of avarice, perhaps, are born out of that wanting, of that liking something. When something's unpleasant, we try to figure out how to get rid of it. A lot of our afflictive emotions are born out of this, out of the unpleasant side of things. When things are pleasant, we don't necessarily particularly feel like we may not feel like we're too reactive when things are pleasant. But think about what happens to you when something pleasant ends. Or think about perhaps the state of mind around which you might be in if you If you have something pleasant and you start to think about, what if this pleasant thing goes away? You know, you have a lovely relationship, and then you start to think about, well, what if that person starts getting attracted to somebody else? Jealousy is born. Fear is born. So even having things that we like can produce these afflictive emotions through this wish to keep, the wish to hold on. So when something's unpleasant, and that includes the ending of pleasant, we often react with aversive emotions, anger, fear, irritation, despair, depression, annoyance, a whole host of difficult emotions. And we can start trying to figure out how to fix or control or manipulate this difficult, unpleasant experience. So this, the fact that emotions are kind of the seed, let's say, the seed of emotions lies in this aspect of feeling, of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, brings me to the first thing I'd like to talk about with respect to bringing mindfulness to our experience around emotions. One really helpful tool for working with emotions is to begin to keep track of what is pleasant and unpleasant in particular in our experience. In with respect to neutral experience, we can also react to neutral experience. If things are too neutral for us, we often get bored, or perhaps confused, or perhaps dull, or spacey, or sleepy. So there can be a reaction even to experience that's neutral. Or sometimes if it's too neutral, we start cooking up things. It's like we get drawn to create something that's pleasant or unpleasant when things are neutral, because we don't tend to connect with neutrality too much. So if things are neutral, we start trying to find things that are pleasant or unpleasant in our experience to connect to those. So to keep track of what's pleasant and unpleasant in our experience. This is a kind of a subtle thing for us. But just right now, just kind of close your eyes for a second and allow yourself to connect to the first most obvious experience that you have. What's the most obvious experience that you can connect with right now? Whatever that is, see if you can touch into whether the experience of that thing is pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. See if you can kind of at least connect to that quality. And now do it again. Pick another sensation that's kind of obvious for you. And what's that one? Is that one pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral? And now I'm going to suggest some things to pay attention to and then let you see whether you think they're pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. The contact of your lips touching each other. The sensation in your hands. The feeling of the breath coming into your body. So do you get a sense of what I mean by the pleasant and unpleasant? Can you touch into that quality? Anybody willing to share a little bit about what you noticed perhaps in this exploration? Anything you care to point to? Yeah, Kate.
My back is cold.
So you noticed cold. Did you notice pleasant or unpleasant about that? Unpleasant. Okay, so it was clear, the unpleasantness. Uh-huh, okay, good.
The second arrow is, why didn't I bring my shawl?
Exactly. So kind of a reactivity to that. It's like, it's not okay to have unpleasant. We react to that. You know, it's like, this is not okay. We think we're not supposed to experience unpleasant, that we are supposed to experience pleasant. And so we end up in our lives trying to manipulate the world to create an environment where things are more pleasant than unpleasant. And this is an endlessly never-ending game. It will never end. We can't finally figure out how to arrange the world such that things will only be pleasant, because things change and those pleasant things end, and then the experience changes, and in the ending of that pleasantness there's often unpleasantness. So we can't construct our world, but we tend to react when we can't do that. We tend to, a lot of these emotions come out when we are unsuccessful in organizing our environment to be the way we'd like it to be. So attending to the feeling is one way to begin to see how emotions are created. Another way in, if you can't, and in daily life in particular, in sitting meditation, you can often kind of check in and say, okay, what is the feeling tone? What is this pleasant? Is this unpleasant? Is this neutral? In daily life, that can be a little harder because the feeling tone's a little subtle. But often we can tell whether we like something or don't like something. And that's kind of just a step away from the feeling tone, because the liking is almost always associated with something pleasant. The not liking is associated with things unpleasant. And usually we can know whether we like something or not like something. So that's another way in here to seeing how emotions are created. You know, the pathway of emotions being created begins with this feeling of pleasant or unpleasant, and then quickly moves from that, from pleasant to liking, to wanting, to needing to have, to demanding to have, to clinging on to and not wanting to let go of that thing, to that kind of grasping quality. So that's kind of the trajectory, and it happens like that for us. It happens really fast. But with mindfulness and with the kind of investigation to both pleasant, unpleasant, and the liking, not liking, we can begin to kind of get a little bit of a mindfulness wedge into this process of emotions being born. Emotions come into being through this stepwise fashion. And if we can actually notice pleasant or unpleasant, or liking or not liking, and be mindful of that, there's actually an opportunity for the mindfulness to just rest and go, oh yeah, this is pleasant, I like this. Or this is unpleasant, I don't like this. Without then leaping to, I should have done, I need to do, gotta fix, gotta change. Just, yeah, this is unpleasant, I don't like this. The mind can rest there with mindfulness. It can rest there. It won't always. But there is a kind of an opportunity in knowing how emotions are constructed to explore the ground out of which they come into being. So I've been talking a little bit about, mostly about the reactivity to bodily experience. We also, as I alluded to a few minutes ago, we react to mental unpleasant experience and pleasant experience. So we react to our emotions themselves. You know, we like certain emotions, we don't like other emotions. We think certain emotions are good, certain emotions are bad. We praise ourselves for having certain feelings, and we blame ourselves for having other feelings. So emotions can get layered. Mind states layer on top of other mind states. So, for instance, most of my examples seem to be in the realm of the aversive afflictive emotions, because that's my tendency. Those are the ones I know really well. So those are the examples I can readily draw from. So, for example, layering of some of these difficult negative emotions might be, we might start by noticing that there's fear. And through noticing that there's fear, by just being willing to hang out with fear, we might begin to notice that there's, with noticing that there's anger, we might begin to notice that there's fear underneath the anger. And then perhaps that there's a feeling of vulnerability underneath the fear. So, the vulnerability is kind of one of a deeper layer, and on top of that comes some fear, and on top of that is layered anger. So that, again, that kind of reactivity can happen so fast that we don't notice it. We just think we're angry. We just think there's anger. So a way into exploring this kind of unlayering is just to notice what's obvious. We may think we know what's underneath our emotions. And we may have a good sense of that based on exploration, of our history. We may have done some therapy and have a sense that we have some patterns going. We may have seen this pattern with mindfulness before and know that very often when we get angry, that fear underlies that and vulnerability underlies that. But actually, when we're practicing mindfulness of emotions, it's most helpful to just notice what's obvious. We can have some idea that we've been stabbing ourselves with multiple arrows here. We can wake up in the midst of a pattern and kind of see, wow, I've been stabbing myself with arrows for the last 10 minutes and have a sense that there's a lot of layering going on. But what's most important is to just pay attention to what's obvious on the outside. What's the obvious experience around this emotion? What does anger feel like? So this is about turning towards the experience of anger. In our usual way of dealing with emotions, we seem to put our attention out in the world. It's like there are things out there that are making us happy or sad or angry or frustrated or excited. And we think that's it's the world that we need to adjust or change or fix in order to either keep going with certain emotions or to let go of other emotions. So in the practice of mindfulness of emotions, the whole key is to let go of the kind of whatever the source we think the emotion is out in the world, and instead turn around and attend to what does it feel like to be in this emotional state? What does it feel like? So that's the kind of main shift that we make to attend to emotions with mindfulness, to let go of the things that we are thinking are making us angry and turn towards the experience of the anger. Now, as I talked about the other day, there's three basic components of emotion. There's the component of the mental tone, the feeling in the mind, the actual feeling of the emotional state. There's the bodily experience of the emotion. And then there's the thoughts associated with the emotion. So in this exploration of turning towards the emotion, we can attend to any of those three components. We can attend to the thoughts that are produced, we can attend to the feeling in the mind, or we can attend to the bodily sensations. So that turning towards means turn towards what happens in our bodies and minds when we're feeling that emotion. Now, I'd like to say that while we can pay attention to any of those things, it's more challenging to pay attention to the thoughts. It's most helpful initially in bringing attention. I did talk about attending to the thoughts some last week in terms of noticing the thoughts that might help you identify an emotion. We talked about the story of anger, he done me wrong. We talked about the story of fear, what if? So you might begin to notice, or I'm afraid, that was one that came up for me. I noticed my mind saying, I'm afraid. And that helped clue me into fear was what was happening. So a little bit of attention to thoughts can help us to identify the emotion. But if we allow the thoughts to continue, they tend to be a fuel for the thoughts. And so one really helpful tool in turning towards the emotions is to let go of the thoughts as much as possible in favor of primarily connecting with the feeling in the body. How does this emotion impact the body? So that's one of the tools, another of the big tools for working with emotions, with mindfulness, getting familiar with how particular emotions impact the body. Fear might feel like tension, tightness, might be contraction in the throat or contraction in the stomach, or a fluttering in the heart. Anger might be pressure and heat. Joy feels like lightness. Excitement has a light quality, but also has an agitated quality. The mind feels a little bit busy. So there's distinct feelings that go along with each emotion. So getting familiar with that, one of the ways to explore emotions in our experience, beginning to notice as we turn towards an experience of an emotion, what does it feel like, particularly in the body? Now I'm going to go back to the layering, because I didn't quite finish my thoughts on the layering. Exploration of emotion, and we may have some sense that, I feel angry, and I know that fear might be underneath that. And so sometimes we think what we need to do is find the fear, because we know that we have that tendency to have the fear underneath the anger. You may be able to find that. You may be able to notice that. If you have experience or familiarity with the pattern of fear that underlies anger. But often that kind of jumping over is actually ignoring what's primarily up in the mind and body at the moment. So if anger is up at the moment, that may be a reaction to fear. But that's what's actually happening right now, is this reaction to fear that's producing anger. So it's most helpful to just see if you can meet whatever is most obvious about what you're experiencing right now, as opposed to having some idea what I really should be trying to find or pay attention to is what's at the core of this. That's what's going to make me feel better. In general, that has some kind of an agenda to get rid of this whole pattern of emotion, to get rid of the whole complex of this difficult feeling. And that action is itself motivated by aversion. So I got to get rid of this. I can get rid of this by finding the core and meeting that. And so that's actually cultivating more aversion. So the practice of mindfulness, it's so simple. It's actually very simple. It's not easy, but it's very simple. Just meet whatever is obvious about your emotional experience. Can you do that? Can you just turn towards anger? Anger feels like this. And noticing in the body, pressure, tension, contraction, heat, tightness. One way to explore emotions and begin to kind of see what happens, how mindfulness impacts our emotional experience, is a kind of a going back and forth between the bodily experience and what's happening in our mental realm as well. So for instance, you're paying attention to some emotion. Depression. Feeling that feeling of depression in the body. Turning towards the feeling, heaviness, tightness. In that exploration, you're focusing on the body. Not so much on the quality of depression in the mind, but the feeling in the body. So heaviness, tightness, tension, that kind of quality perhaps in the body around this feeling of depression. And then after you've spent a little bit of time in the body like that, can be really helpful to then check in and say, and what's happened in the mind? What's my mental experience right now? Oh, actually, right now what I'm feeling is sad. I feel really sad. And how does that feel? Oh, there's a kind of an ache in the heart. So kind of then go back to the body. Notice, sometimes when you do this exploration of the body, the emotion shifts a little bit in the mind. So go back and check in. What's happening in the mind? And then come back to the body and check in. How does that one feel in the body? And you can go back and forth like that, checking into what the body feels like and then the mind. And in this way, you can also begin to uncover some of these layers of experience. Because often when we get out of the mental proliferation, the mental spinning of our thoughts, the emotions begin to shift and change. And the ability to just stay with them with mindfulness also allows them to kind of live their lives. The emotions kind of have a natural, to me they feel like a wave-like quality. They kind of rise and crest and then cascade out for a little while. And when we can bring mindfulness to emotions, they can have that, they live their life in a very natural way. And they don't tend to stay around for as long as they do when we spin in our thoughts. You're angry with somebody. He shouldn't have done that. She shouldn't have said that. I've got to figure this out. I've got to fix it. I've got to make sure I say that thing to that person and make sure they understand. We spin in our minds. It just keeps feeding the anger. If we can let go of the thoughts and just feel the feeling, it can take some time to have the confidence to do this, and it's a kind of a non-intuitive approach. I mean, it's like the feelings that we feel in the body and the mental feeling of the emotions, these difficult afflictive emotions, are often not pleasant. And so, you know, a lot of times the thoughts around our emotions are trying to figure out, how can I get rid of this feeling? How can I get rid of this feeling? I don't like this feeling. Whereas when we begin to pay attention with mindfulness, we can begin to develop the trust that with mindfulness, the emotion will live its own life, and it will crest and it will fade out. There's one study, or not study, but a kind of a fact about the brain that I read in this book called My Stroke of Insight. Have some of you read this book? It's a really, really interesting book about a woman, a neurobiologist, a neuroanatomist, I think she was, and she had a stroke. And she, in the process of having the stroke, realized that this was what was happening and was watching what was happening in her mind and understood a little bit about the left brain, right brain. She knew, based on what her experience was, because her thoughts just would vanish at some point. She couldn't think. And she would enter into this very spacious, easeful place that didn't seem to matter that she was having this stroke. And then some of her mental processes would kick back in and be like, oh, I've got to get to the phone. How can I find a phone? How can I dial this phone? And she did manage to get help and recovered from her stroke and managed to write this book. But in that book, she talks about what she calls the 90-second rule or something like that. That when an emotion happens when an emotion begins in our brain, you know, some chemical neurotransmitters are released and they release some hormones into the body. So there's a kind of a flush through the body based on an emotion arising. It lasts for a little while, that kind of flush through the body. It lasts for a little while. It lasts for about 90 seconds. That's pretty amazing, actually. 90 seconds for one flush of kind of a hit of emotion. But what we do is we keep hitting it. We keep it going with more thoughts, more, this is the way, it's not supposed to be this way. We keep flooding our bodies with these hormones, so it lasts longer than 90 seconds. So what she said to herself in knowing this, in her brain beginning to recover from its stroke, initially she was in a very spacious place because large parts of her left brain were incapacitated, and her right brain was fully functional, and that seems to be the part of the brain that's really open, expansive, connected to experience. The right brain is the one that judges, that thinks, that categorizes, that discriminates. And so there was less of that need to react with this part of her brain damaged. But as her brain started to heal, her reactivity started to come back. And knowing this little fact, she began to just essentially use mindfulness. She talked about stepping to the right side of her brain. Can I just hang out in this just right side of my brain while this thing flushes through me? And let it pass within its 90 seconds. So this is what we're attempting to do with mindfulness. Can we actually just meet the feeling, let it live its natural life? It's not very long if we're not feeding it. And we keep feeding it. This is our practice. This is our practice where we really have to just keep noticing when the habit of feeding those emotions is so strong that even with the intention to just be mindful, those thoughts will jump in. Say, oh, but he shouldn't have done that. Oh, just notice, okay. That frustration is back again. So just that willingness to continue turning towards begins to unwind, in a sense, our emotions. And in terms of the layering, you know, just meeting whatever's on the outside is really, really enough. Meeting what's ever obvious is enough. We don't have to jump in and dive into the middle of what we think might be underneath. Why don't I stop there and open it to questions? I don't want to... I've got way more to say, but let's see what you have to say. Lewis, use the mic.
I think one thing that strikes me is that often...
Yeah, hold it kind of like an ice cream cone.
It's for the recording.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Oh. Just that it seems as though the wrapper isn't necessarily, the wrapper is so big that it's sometimes, one can, it's just a question of where one puts one's attention sometimes.
So
nothing's terribly strong. I mean, when you posed that first question, I noticed there's a pain in the ankle, but there's a very pleasant feeling in the mind, and, it's sort of like they're both just balancing there. There was nothing obvious going on.
Mm-hmm.
I could say either one.
Mm-hmm. So just so that others could hear, I know there's some people using the hearing assisted devices. He was talking about sometimes there's not anything particularly obvious about what's pleasant or unpleasant, and that the mind could choose to go to one or the other, and that there's no particular reactivity. Is that what you're talking about? And so that just sounds like balance of mind. You know, the mind can be balanced in the space of pleasant and unpleasant. That's what begins to happen for us as the practice deepens. That, yeah, there can just be pleasant, unpleasant. We might notice a little bit of, yeah, don't like that, prefer that. maybe a tendency to go towards the pleasant one and ignore the unpleasant one, or maybe a tendency the other way. I tend to have a tendency the other way. Yeah, oh, I should pay attention to that unpleasant one. That's, my mind seems calm right now. I'll go to that unpleasant one. That's what would be most important to do. So, you know, we have our patterns, our tendencies to be drawn to things, but not with a lot of reactivity. But, you know, so in that kind of a state, it's really about just noticing, is there any subtle movement of liking or not liking? Just noticing that. So that realm, that's not the realm too much of strong emotion that you're talking about. Yeah. Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
I don't know if this adds or detracts from anything you've said, but I was just thinking about this whole philosophy of observing your emotions, and I was comparing it against everything I know of the field of psychotherapy and psychiatry, etc., where the great canonical thinking is, if you're feeling down, you know, here's an antidepressant for you, which is all intended to sort of put up this wall between these difficult emotions so that you're not sucked in. And in the Buddhist way, it's kind of, I don't know if it's making friends with the emotions or not buying in, but they just seem to be two opposite camps, the way I hear it. And it gets kind of confusing.
So, there's another instruction that I haven't talked about yet that I'll go ahead and mention. And this is for when emotions get overwhelming. So my understanding, I mean, it's possible, I mean, it's very possible that people are medicating for non-overwhelming emotions. That I wouldn't think would be terribly helpful. There are times when emotions do get overwhelming. And the instruction in that case is not to turn towards the emotion. So, for instance, if you find that in trying to attend with mindfulness to a particular emotion, it just feels like, it's like that emotion is so powerful, it just like sucks you into the vortex. This was my experience around anger when I first started over the course of my exploration with anger, as I began to understand how mindfulness worked. It's like, okay, anger comes up, turn towards the experience of anger, and I would discover myself a few minutes later just really lost in the story of why I was so angry and why I was justified in that anger. So it was feeding. The attempt to be mindful wasn't working. And so I needed to learn something else, and I began to realize, okay, it's not so helpful for me when this particular anger comes up. It was a particular anger at a particular person. When this particular anger comes up, it's not so helpful for me to try to put my attention there. I'm going to try instead to put my attention elsewhere. So it's kind of a skillful ignoring in a way, and it has to be done without aversion. So it needs to be a kind of out of compassion almost. It's like, I see this not so helpful for me to try to be mindful of this anger right now. So I'm going to put my attention in my feet. And I was able to do that with that anger. I was able to ignore it, basically kind of say, you do your thing in the background. I'm not going to try to stop you. I'm not going to try to stop this anger, but I'm going to put my attention in my feet. It seemed like I mostly got angry when I was walking. My mind would run rampant when I was walking, and I would end up in these states of anger. So just putting my attention, feet contacting the ground, seemed to be a neutral experience that I could connect with that helped me to not feed the anger, but also to not necessarily connect with it. So it's kind of like ignoring it, letting it be in the background. So I can imagine there are times when certain patterns of emotions, certain habits, certain life experiences lead to such an overwhelming emotion that it's nearly impossible for mindfulness to get strong enough to meet it. In that case, I think antidepressants can be very helpful. or some kind of medication to help tamp down on the anxiety so that one can begin to meet some of those feelings with mindfulness. So there are places where I think they do merge, but I think there probably is an over-medication going on. I think there's a lot of anxiety, depression, sadness that could be met with mindfulness if people were willing to do that. So, you know, sometimes people are not willing to go there. And if they're not willing to do that, you know, then the mindfulness isn't going to get strong. So, I mean, when something's overwhelming, I think there are places and times to bring in some therapy, some psychotherapy, some meditation, to help create some stability, to allow us then to be able to meet our experience a little more easily. So does that help a little?
Very much so. Because my understanding of antidepressants is it creates a certain, I don't know if it's numbness or we are not swallowed up
right.
by it. But I kept asking myself as I was listening to you talk, do you still get to, you're talking about the core,
mm-hmm.
which who knows how many layers you have to go to. Is there just the numbing out? And I'm not asking you as if you're a psychiatrist, but...
Yeah, I don't know how the numbing out works in the antidepressants. I've not taken them, and I don't know how deep it goes. But I do know people who have gone on and off antidepressants who are who are meditators, who have found it useful for a time to get their balance back, and then wean themselves off and bring the mindfulness in.
Yeah.
There have been people that I know that have merged the two. I want to say a little bit more about that technique of putting aside. I found in my own exploration of this that it's generally helpful when you're ignoring something, particularly something that's difficult, to turn your attention to something neutral as opposed to something pleasant. That may be a little counterintuitive, but what I've found is that, you know, in turning to something pleasant, somehow that energy of the a difficult emotion feels dismissed or feels like, well, you said I could do this in the background, but, you know, you're really trying to stuff me because you're trying to pay attention to something pleasant here. So something neutral seems to be an easier place to connect when something difficult is going on in the background. So that's... I just offer that to you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, in the back.
I just like to say that I was always taught, or have been taught, that anger is never appeased by anger. And something was mentioned to me. I was going through a divorce and had a lot of anger and hostility toward my wife. And my teacher said that, you know, that I should practice more loving kindness, and especially direct it toward her.
Mm-hmm. And was that possible for you?
Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh.
I mean, not at first. I mean, of
right.
course,
you know, yeah.
I still had a lot of ill will to deal with.
Yeah.
And actually, as a matter of fact, I really did. When he said that, I mean, I knew he was going to say that, but I really didn't want to acknowledge it, right? I was more into thinking about choking her, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I'd go out and do a walking meditation, you know, and like the whole hour, you know, I'd be like directing those loving kindness thoughts toward her. And over a period of time, you know, it started, you know, those feelings of hostility and ill will started to subside.
Uh-huh. And that can be done. I mean, that actually is one of the classic antidotes for anger and fear is to bring metta in. In my own mind, I had to wait before the hostility subsided enough before the metta would work. So, you know, I had to use more neutrality for a while. And then I began actually noticing spontaneous thoughts of metta for the person. And that's when I began cultivating the metta. I mean, so that so different minds work differently. And some minds really rebel against that going towards metta when there's that strong hostility. Some minds can do it. Check your own mind out. See which kind it is. Thank you for bringing that up. Yeah. And over here.
I just have a couple things to say. As a person that has been on antidepressant medication for some years now, it doesn't prevent you from having bad feelings at all. It's just what it prevents, for me at least, is, you know, like you mentioned, that there's a hormone that's released, for instance, when you have an emotional experience. I think for those of us that are on antidepressant medications or medications, they help us turn off those hormones.
Uh-huh.
Where normally they don't turn off in some cases.
Uh-huh.
And so you're not like the normal mind that, you know, sort of has these experiences and then resets and goes back to everything. So like if you have anxiety, it just
keeps going, right?
And anxious, and it really, you'd have to have a skillful practice, I think, already in place before you have that kind of a crisis.
Right.
Before you could actually be useful. You have to have some skillfulness.
I agree, yeah.
And then the other thing is, why suffer? I mean, if you have those tools available, you know, you can take a Wellbutrin or some kind of medication that would reduce your suffering, and you have that available. I think it's more efficient to do that. So,
well, again,
I think there's a lot of suffering, and I think, you know, a lot of people are suffering emotionally, and I mean, I think sometimes it does, the cultural reasons for it get overlooked, but still, I don't know that not taking antidepressants in this culture is going to make that change.
Yeah, I mean, you have some excellent points there, especially around the, you know, in the strong emotion, that kind of an area. I completely support taking antidepressants. I do question, you know, somebody. I would hope that the people wouldn't just, you know, medicate for, you know, a mild depression and just kind of say, oh, I feel a little down today. Maybe I'll take a Wellbutrin. You know, because I think that is a kind of a non-willingness to kind of meet the natural ebbs and flows of life. I mean, suffering is a kind of natural part of life. And we in our culture have this belief that it is not a natural part of life, that we're supposed to always be happy. And that's actually delusion. You know, that things happen. People die, people, you know, loved ones die. We lose things for fire. There's war. There's suffering in the world, and the ability to connect with that actually begins to open the heart to compassion. So if we are just continually cutting off the suffering, we're kind of also cutting off that avenue towards compassion. So it's a we are a very stressed out culture, and a lot of people are overwhelmed by anxiety, and it's definitely helpful. I mean, I've seen it be helpful for many people. So,
and I too have a lot of issues with anger. Seems to be my aversive emotion of choice, and it's hard to get out of it sometimes, but I kind of sometimes what helps me is that I look at my anger and my conflict in the bigger scheme of things.
Mm-hmm.
And I realize it's pretty minor.
Yes. Yeah, that's kind of a reframing.
Yeah,
it's a reframing. Yeah, definitely. And there's it's now 9:00, so I'll continue next week. There's way more to say about emotions. See you next week, some of you.